to 10 p.m. Eastern in Studio B at Revolution.radio.
Moscow's freeze. That's your cerebral cortex looking for an answer it doesn't have.
See? Even your brain knows you're screwed.
Your body's filling with adrenaline right now. Whether you know it or not, your heart's beating fast. It's getting a little harder to breathe. The neurobiological system is telling it to run, but your knees are too weak to move.
Fear is not real. The only place that fear can exist is in our thoughts of the future. It is a product of our imagination, causing us to fear things that do not at present and may not ever exist. That is near insanity. Do not misunderstand me. Danger is very real, but fear is a choice. We are all telling ourselves a story.
You're listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. 100% listener-supported radio. Reporting the danger. Unafraid. Right here, where information never sleeps. Revolution. Revolution. Radio!
I think of you as an inspiration in my radio career.
You must be some kind of a kook.
Thank you.
It's hard out here for a pimp.
All right, listen up, y'all.
A bunch of a-holes.
Where are you going to go? Where are you going to run? Where are you going to hide?
Ladies and gentlemen, may I have your attention, please?
Check your systems are offline.
Hashtag's confused, dude.
What time of feeling? I'm high on believing that you're in love with me.
I'm not good enough for life.
Central, 404 Mountain, 304 West Coast, 604 East Coast. Good evening, Iceland. Happy Friday, Australia. Welcome, my friends, to the award-winning but yet to be nominated This, That, and the Other Heard every Monday and Thursday here in Revolution Radio, located at revolution.radio, common spelling in your favorite internet browser. We do this every time. You know the drill. Head over to the website. Click on the donations tab. I'm providing you the link in the room. Donate. It keeps this 800,000-watt internet blowtorch a-rolling. And I'm not even going to give – you know, I'm going on strike, sort of. I'm no longer going to advertise for anybody to create their award-winning program because you sons of bitches never pay attention to me. I provided open invites. Top-notch preparation for this program. Sold the shit out of other programs. And some of you sons of bitches in chat, I think, are capable of hosting your own program, and for some reason, you don't want to. So you know what? Go kick rocks. I'm not talking about it anymore. You're smart enough to figure it out. You want to host your own program? You figure out where to go and who to contact, because I'm done. I'm boycotting it. I'm doing something. I'm not talking about it anymore. Good evening, Net Effect, Do Guy, Flippy, Patrick Cornelius Rabbit III, my favorite chatter, Quality Redemptions. Where is, there's Mr. Rowe. Mr. Rowe, apparently in 1966, urged her brother at Harvard. She created the role of Catwoman in Batman. Oh, well, that's exciting. Speaking of 1966, but not really, next month, I would have graduated from high school 32 years ago. My math is wrong. 32 years ago. Boy, that puts everything in perspective, eh? Well, let's get on with it. Dateline singular. Yes, Mr. Rowe. Sons of bitches. Oh, speaking of sons of bitches, you know what? I never realized. You know the Airplane series? I don't mean the comedies with Leslie Nielsen. I mean what Airplane. There were three Airplane movies. One was with Jack Lemmon. I'm blanking on the other guy's name. Owned a private island and had a bunch of Jimmy Stewart and some other folks. And apparently the Boeing 747 was sabotaged and sank in the Bermuda Triangle on a low reef. There's another one with Charlton Heston. Look, I'm not saying Charlton Heston was a bad actor, but look, he played himself in every movie. What else? So those old 1977, you know, Airplane, not the comedies. I was watching those, and you know what? For the special effects at the time, not too bad. Not too bad. Now, you should always shave your dog's head. Airport 77. Yes, Dude Guy, that's it. Airport 77. That's the one. That's the one. Not a promotion for one of the streaming services, but it's on one of the streaming services, at least the three films. Yeah, again, the one with Charlton Heston. It's where he was a passenger, and there was, I guess, a famous actress at the time. Yes, that's it, Dude Guy. A famous actress at the time who was a flight attendant, flight stewardess, and the plane was hit by a little puddle jumper. And as you can imagine, Charlton Heston, with the help of ground control, and what was his name? George. Oh, he was in the Eiger Sanction with Clint Eastwood. George. I can't believe I'm blanking on all these. I just watched it the other day. Who was the cast character in Eiger Sanction? I mean, he's been in a shit ton of movies. A crap ton of movies. George Kennedy, that's who it is. George Kennedy was in there. Look, I'm not saying they were award winning, but they weren't bad. They weren't bad. Let's get on with it. From singular14.com, link in the chat room. Asan Ishmal, age 37, an e-hailing driver in Kuching, the capital of the most populous city in the state of Sarawak in Malaysia, said recently in a Facebook post of all things that on May 2nd of this year, 2023, he had given a ride to a ghost.
No.
That's now the sound effect I'll be playing every time people just report stupid things. Come on now. if you give a ride to a ghost, how do you know the person was even in your car? I'm just saying. Let's continue. According to Harrian Metro, Asan said that he had received an order at around midnight to pick up a passenger near the Samarin Heart Center and take them to the pending Islamic cemetery. Okay. Although initially skeptical of the drop-off location, Asan said he assumed that the passenger had merely selected a nearby landmark. Quote, as soon as I arrived at the pickup location, I saw a woman in a dark-colored baju kurung, a traditional dress, and a headscarf. The area was dark, so I didn't see her face. After all, she's a woman, so I don't want to see very much for fear that she is uncomfortable, he said. But I could hear her delicate voice when she asked me to lower the back window. Asan did not chat with the woman and only focused on driving to the intended destination. I don't know if I can continue with the story. During the drive, he did not suspect anything unusual about the passenger. What I remember is that her scent was very fragrant, but I still didn't think she was a ghost or anything because it's normal to smell a passenger's fragrance, he said. Oh, all right. It was when they arrived at the cemetery that Asan noticed something strange was going on. Quote, as soon as I arrived at the location, I told the woman that we had arrived, but she didn't respond. I called again, but she was silent, he said. I thought she was asleep, but was surprised to find that the passenger was gone when I looked back. All I remembered of the woman were several banknotes on the seat. I don't know. You can read the rest of the story. My thought is maybe she just got out of the car and threw the banknotes in the back seat and left. But look, I've been doing this long enough to know that if it's posted on Facebook or Instagram or Twitter or name your favorite social media communication app, web page, what have you, man, it's got to be true. It's got to be true, kids. So there's that. There's that. A Skeptic's Guide to Finding Bigfoot. Let me post this in the room because I'm not going to go through it all because, I mean, I'm not quite certain why there would even be a guide if technically no one has found Bigfoot. Nowhere to go. Our most Sasquatch sightings in New York have been in Whitetail. Recent happenings hint that the group may have relocated to Faro Lake Wilderness. Oh, okay. I think Bigfoot, or big feet, I guess that's the plural today, are just nomads. Or should I say no people now? I don't know. What's politically correct with Bigfoot? No people? No nomads? I mean, just walking the earth like Kane from Kung Fu. And if you're a David Carradine fan, dismiss the narrative in which he passed away. But Kung Fu wasn't a bad TV series. Nowhere to go, know what to look for. You need to look for a creature between 6'6 and 10 feet tall. Weight anywhere between 400 and 1,000 pounds. That's a 600-pound range, kids. Feet anywhere between 12 and 22 inches long, 5 to 11 inches wide, and 2 to 8 inches wide at the heel. Hands anywhere between 6 and 8 and a half inches across the palm. Allegedly stubby fingers, hair dark brown reddish, skin black brown tan, eyes brown red, odor not good. So if you're looking for Bigfoot, that's what you need to do. Speaking of Bigfoot, there is a Alaska Bigfoot encounter. They are having a conversation with Truckin' with Tim and the Kenai Sasquatch. I got no clue what this is about. I don't even know if it will last the whole entire time, but it sounded pretty interesting. So we're going to give it a listen. If we let it go, and if we keep it going, it stays interesting. If we turn it off, it's not interesting, and I'll be the judge of that. I will post for you in the chat room the official channel.
Made to-
to the Bigfoot Society. So if you wish, you can.
I'm gonna have to shoot this thing and empty my gun into
Head over to these folks and give them a little listen to it. Because unlike David Plais on this show, we like to cite our sources. Here we go.
I pull over in these spots and sleep. So I'm thinking to myself, oh my gosh, he saw my truck. He saw
head
me.
Head over to these folks.
I could imagine
a little listen to it.
On the side of the road like trying to sleep and him out there. Because
like
I was in that semi, and it's a big semi truck. And I felt small. And I just kind of envisioned him wrapping. He could probably wrap his arm around the cab of the truck and just shake the whole thing.
Welcome to the Bigfoot Society podcast. In this episode, I talked to Tim, a long-haul trucker from the Kenai Peninsula in Alaska. What exactly did Tim see those nights while driving down the Seward Highway? Find out this and more on this episode of the Bigfoot Society podcast.
Look, let me just pause it there. I'm already interested. Do you want to know why? Because the folks that have the best stories are the over-the-road truck drivers, specifically those who are on the road between 10 p.m. and 6 a.m. This should be good.
All right, Bigfoot Society, we've got the privilege of talking to Tim from Alaska today. He had said that he's had some very interesting encounters that happened up there in the state of Alaska. How's it going tonight, Tim?
I'm doing all right. Thank you.
Is there anything else that the listeners should know about your background that will help with you sharing your stories tonight?
At the time when I saw him, I was long hauling between Anchorage, Seward, Kenai, Fairbanks, and the particular area that I saw these two encounters, I drove every single day, sometimes twice a day. And so I was very familiar with the scenery, just everything as far as along the road.
Sounds good. Let's go ahead and I'll have you start right in with your stories of what you saw when you were long haul trucking.
Okay. The first encounter was, I believe it was end of September, beginning of October. The leaves had already fallen off the trees, so you could see pretty clear the brush that in the particular area that I was at was pretty low lying. It was probably about 5 foot tall. And I was just driving along and I come around a corner and I saw somebody walking across the street or the road. And I was just out in the middle of nowhere, and before I come around the corner, there's a cabin right here on this corner that people would frequent throughout the summer and stuff. And I didn't see any vehicles there when I came around the corner, so I was puzzled when I saw the person walking across the street. And at a glimpse, it looked like they were wearing dark brown corduroys with a real light tan shirt, pretty slender, real long hair, like down to the shoulders on the upper facial area, which I thought just, somebody that had long hair. I was just thinking to myself, well, that's odd that somebody was out here in the middle of nowhere. I didn't see anybody at the cabin. So I'm wondering if they're parked up around the corner. There's another corner about half a mile or so past where I saw him walking. And he wasn't going very fast. Normally, like a typical regular person, they see somebody come and they scurry across the road. And they just very lackadaisious, very slow, just like not a care in the world. And I kicked myself in the butt for not watching a little bit longer, because as soon as he got to about quarter turn, I guess, or about halfway to looking to his shoulder, I checked my rear view mirrors, because sometimes people, even out in the middle of nowhere, would be right on your butt following you in a semi. And as slow as he was going, I figured I might have to slam on my brakes here pretty quick. I better double check, make sure anybody's not on my butt. And when I looked, there wasn't anybody, and I was watching, and that's about when I saw Bigfoot walk up to the guardrail, and that's when I realized what I was looking at, because when he went to step over, the guardrail came up about halfway, maybe just a little bit over halfway up the shin. And I was always a see it to believe it kind of person, and I just couldn't believe my eyes, and I'm just thinking, no way, that can't be what I think it is. And I'm driving, I think, around 70, 72 miles an hour, and I'm like, I'm going to be there in about 1 to 2 seconds, if not sooner. And I just kept watching, and it just looked like it floated, just glided down the side of the embankment, which was probably, I'm guessing, 10 to 15 feet, maybe. And knowing where he had gone off the road there, it was, like I had mentioned, a low-lying brush, and it was open. And I said, if that's what I think it is, I'll be there in a second, and I'm going to see it. And that second came, and I slowed down, and I was looking. I figured it'd be running. I didn't really know what to expect. And I ended up passing the area and just sitting there thinking to myself, like, that had to have been a moose. I'm trying to make up some kind of logical explanation in my mind for what I just witnessed. So I was trying to think of, you know, like on a four-legged animal, they're, I don't know if I'd say hinging, but you can see how they walk versus just it glided right down the side of the bank there. And as tall as it was, it would have been standing way above the brush that had no leaves on it. And I thought, maybe if it's laying down, I'm up high enough in the semi where I can see down, and I could see the floor of the tundra up there. But that was the first experience.
Do you mind if I ask you a few follow-up questions about that story?
Sure.
That's a fascinating story. Just the fact that you said the guardrail went halfway up his shin, that's incredible, or up the creature's shin. How far away were you from the nearest town or civilization? It sounds like it was a kind of a remote area.
I'd probably say the nearest town to me was Cooper's Landing, which is down on the Kenai Peninsula, south of Anchorage, about maybe hour and a half, 2 hours or so. It's very small. I got one grocery store and maybe a couple things. That's about it. It was probably about 15 miles or so from there. So I was really kind of out in the remote, but it was a very remote wilderness where I was at. Alaska's pretty vast.
Did you notice anything about the creature's arms when you saw it for just a few seconds?
It looked like the arms had hung down longer than normal, because it almost looked like it wasn't quite all the way to the knee, but it was, or maybe around the knee. I can't recall the specifics. Everything seemed like it happened in slow motion, but it all happened pretty quick because he was walking sideways. I could, it just like a beanstalk kind of tall person, I thought, when I initially saw it.
If you had to give an estimate as to how tall the creature was, what would you say?
9 to 10 foot tall.
Wow. And Tim, did you notice anything about the head structure or the top part of the creature when you saw it for a few seconds?
Nothing out of the ordinary other than thinking it was like somebody that had really long hair down to shoulder, maybe a little bit below shoulder. And I would have probably thought that the hair just was parted or something and you couldn't really cover in the face a little bit. I can't think of anything else right off the top of my head other than being darker on that lower half and a lot lighter to a dirty blonde on the upper. It just looked like it just didn't have a care in the world, and that was one of my first thoughts, was I didn't want to run him over or anything like that.
How did that sighting affect the rest of your travel that day?
I was in disbelief. I was really just kind of, I kept telling myself it had to have been a moose. It had to have been something else other than that. And I was just trying to tell myself without freaking myself out. And I was a little bit worried of, you know, about saying anything because I'm just not one to tell a story, especially something like that, and then I don't want to be ridiculed or anything like that.
It's very interesting because I believe in your account you had said that you saw it on two legs, but yet the human mind, when it sees something like that, it's trying to make sense of what is it that I saw. It's got to be a moose. It's got to be something else. There's no way it could be that. And that's just such a fascinating detail for you to throw in there. Were you actually able to see it cross the road then?
When I first come around the corner, I looked at that house or the cabin there, and it was just starting on the passing lane. It probably was just like maybe I don't think it was even halfway into the oncoming traffic lane going from left to right. So I had watched it those, probably it was only a couple steps, but it,
if I had seen that, I would just be replaying that over and over in my mind a few times for sure. That is fascinating. Thank you for sharing that. Around Cooper Landing, Alaska, on the Kenai Peninsula. Very cool. Do you mind sharing your second encounter, Tim?
The second encounter was just probably about 1 to 2 miles away from that one. And this one was, I think, around February. So it was a few months after that first initial sighting. I'd passed through that area before, like the winter previous. And in that same area, you'd be driving along and you'd look over and there'd be foot, it looked like human foot tracks. And I'd imagine that the snow is pretty deep because some of the moose are pretty tall. They're probably about eight foot or more, at least 8 foot up to about the top of their back. Because the snow is so deep, they have a tendency to walk on the road a lot to just try to preserve their energy. And I have a recording where we were following a moose and it's running down the road. And then after it just got too tired, it jumped off. the moose had just almost disappeared. So that's what I had in mind when I saw those tracks out there, thinking that's odd that it looks like almost human tracks, you know, because if it was a four-legged animal, the underbelly of it would be dragging. The tracks would just be a little probably more shuffled or muddled together, and which was in almost that same area where I saw that initial sighting. And the second one, it was middle of winter, and it was just past it as I'm going north, 1 to 2 miles. And it was probably about midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning, and it was a full moon, so the lights don't carry as well when it's a full moon. And just past where I saw, there's some other where snowmobilers would go generally in the wintertime, and the pullouts are probably 300 feet or so long, and they're pretty wide because they'll be pulling trailers, stuff like that, for their snowmobiles. And it was really cold. I remember that. And it was a full moon. It was probably about 20 below, maybe a little bit colder. And I'm getting tired a little bit. And I get to one of those pullouts. There's two of them. And they're on the right-hand side. And I get to where I could see a little bit, and I see the shadow of something. And when I first initially seen it, it was just kind of walking. I figured it was probably a moose or something. And I hadn't seen any trucks or trailers, anything like that, pulled over there, because sometimes I'd pull doubles a lot, so we're like 134 feet long, so you can't just pull over anywhere. When I first seen it, it just was walking, and the closer I got, it was getting ready to, like, I surprised it, and it was getting ready to bolt to the left, and it made that body gesture movement like it was getting ready to run, and it thinking, oh, might have just said, oh, I'll screw it, I'll just keep going. And so at this point I'm thinking, I'm looking around for vehicles. I thought maybe somebody was broke down, is my initial thought. So I'm looking for vehicles, snowmobiles, anything like that. But I'm also looking on the object to try to see any kind of reflective gear, like a face mask, a visor, or any kind of reflectiveness on the coat or snow pants, gloves, something like that. And I didn't see anything. And the object was just really big. This one I could tell was a lot bigger Bigfoot, and it was wider, and it just was walking, just meandering towards me, so I could see how wide it was, and it must have been about 4 foot wide, maybe a little bit wider, and it's walking towards me, and I'm starting to slow down a little bit, because I'm must have been going about 55, 60. And as I'm watching it, it would stay just on the outside of my light, what my light would carry for my lights. And it's, as I'm getting closer and I'm slowing down and I'm really just focusing on what this is. As I had mentioned, it was about 20, some below. And so I'm thinking if they needed help or anything like that, just etiquette, especially that cold, middle of nowhere. As I'm getting closer, I could see how big the belly was. This belly on this, I couldn't touch my hands together. Maybe three medicine balls, all in one, if not bigger than that. And it just was, had this kind of a waddle. And it was dark because, you know, the moon and stuff was behind it. And this one, I didn't quite get as good of a clear picture as I did during the day of that first one. And but it's walking kind of at a diagonal towards the white line from where it was. And as I'm getting closer, I'm slowing down. I'm probably down 40 or so, and I'm trying to see if they just need help. And I realized how tall it was, and I would then again say it was probably 10, 11 foot tall. And I just, it was like slow motion. As I'm looking out the window, I just forgot where I was. I'm just focused on looking to my right-hand side out of the passenger side as I'm starting to roll up to it, and it just stopped, and it's just staring at me. And I think I'm probably about maybe 8 to 10 feet, maybe a little bit more, not much. I'm just looking at it, and the shoulders, like I said, they were super wide, but the biggest thing that really stuck out was the belly, just because how big he was. And it just stared at me. I couldn't quite see because I couldn't see the top of the head. It was above the what I could see out across the vehicle out of the semi, and so it was taller than, like, the, I don't know how to explain it, what I could see out of the window of the passenger side. So I didn't get a facial look on it, but I just remember it just kind of just watched me by, go by in slow motion. I'm just like, I'm not stopping, if that's what I think it was. And there again, I was just kind of in disbelief, trying to explain to myself and comprehend what I just saw. And I drove the rest of the way to Anchorage, and I didn't say anything for a few months. And that kind of freaked me out, because knowing not only be lucky to see one, but two within that time span. And I'm thinking, that's pretty crazy. First of all, second, I pull over in these spots and sleep. So I'm thinking to myself, oh my gosh, he saw my truck. He saw me. I could imagine on the side of the road trying to sleep, and him out there, because I was in that semi, and it's a big semi truck. And I felt small. And I just kind of envisioned him wrapping. He could probably wrap his arm around the cab of the truck and just shake the whole thing. And thinking, oh, you saw me, freaking me out, peeling the side of the truck open, or I don't know. My mind was starting just kind of racing all over by then. But it was, that one did freak me out, because I pulled over a lot in that area to sleep. I didn't really know what to think or say or do.
That is fascinating. Is that, you said that's also in the Cooper Landing area?
Yeah, it's up by Summit Lake, which is, so they call it the Y. So if you're headed south on, I can't remember the Seward Highway, if you keep going straight, you go to Seward, and then there's a Y as you're kind of
dropping out of the mountains. And if you take the Y, which would be to the right, you go to Cooper Landing. It's about 6-7 miles from the Y. And that'll take you to Kenai, Homer, Soldotna, stuff like that. But where I'd seen both of them was in between Summit Lake, or right by the lake, and the Y, which is, I think it's within 4 to 6 miles.
I'm actually looking at a map right now, and yes, you are correct. There's the lake, there's the Y. You take that exit off, it goes to Cooper Landing. So I can see the exact area that you're talking about between the Y and the lake. That's absolutely fascinating.
And it kind of kept me up for a little bit, and I never stopped back in those areas to sleep anymore after that. It must have been probably in the spring, so it must have been about April. I was in the Cooper, in Cooper's Landing. There's a cafe called the Sunrise Cafe right there, and I'd stop in there a lot and eat, whether it was breakfast or dinner. And I was in there, and there's a gentleman, two of them actually, in there talking about Bigfoot. And the one guy that had mentioned, he said his grandfather had seen families in that area and had homesteaded in that same area where I saw the two. It's probably closer to the first one, because the first one was a little bit closer to the Y. And this was back in the 60s. I can't remember exactly when he had mentioned, but he had said his grandfather had seen families back there in that area back then. He had said, I listened to his story, and then it came down to a pause, and I finally got enough nerve to say, I saw a Bigfoot in that area too.
Wow.
And he turned around and he looked at me and he goes, I believe you. Because I was hesitant to even say anything. And I'm just like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I just said it. Because I'm thinking they're going to say, oh, you're just pulling our leg. He goes, and he asked where it was. And I told him what mile marker it was. And he goes, yeah, it's just up on like 3 miles from there is where his grandfather had homesteaded. And so, yeah, it was.
Do you remember the mile marker?
I think it was around 47, 48, 49.
There's a friend of mine who, he's a Bigfoot researcher, and I don't know if you're familiar with Small Town Monsters, but they had the Beyond the Trail series, and he actually was researching at an area on the Kenai Peninsula, and you can watch that as Alaskan Coastal Sasquatch on YouTube. But he's actually headed back up this summer to the Kenai Peninsula in Alaska again to research for an extended period of time. I'm sure he will find this episode extremely helpful, because you've been descriptive as to where the area, and it sounds like there could be some stuff there. You've had two sightings in that area. You had the gentleman in the 60s that had multiple families that were being seen in that area by where his homestead was. It's just, that's fascinating.
Look between mile marker 41 and 48 on the Seward Highway. I guess if you're going north, it'd be on the right-hand side on Summit Lakeside.
And how long ago did this happen, Tim?
February 10th of 2018, and that was after. So it might have been a month or two. So I might have seen that second one, because that was one that really freaked me out. And really, just being that much closer to it and seeing the size of and feeling that small in a truck that big. And I finally reached out to somebody thinking they might run up there. I didn't know what to really expect when I'd said anything. I didn't know if they ever did or not. So that must have been could have been in December, January of 2017. And the first one would have been in September, October of 2017 as well.
I don't want to overstep, but if you would be able to send any information that you've written down would be extremely helpful in that email. But that Bigfoot Society at gmail.com. Yeah, that would be great. Yeah. Okay. Definitely. That would probably be very helpful to Alex for sure.
Is that it?
Do they go up there?
We're still going?
Is it often or every year?
It's not. Last year they were filming some documentary.
Right, I think we got the gist of Trucker Tim in the stories of a Bigfoot. So there you go. I mean, that's how we do that. Speaking of Bigfoot, Dateline May 9th, 2023. Clallam County in Washington declared refuge for Sasquatch. Look, I get it. I get it. 42 ends at midnight. So you got sanctuary cities. You got a sanctuary county for Bigfoot. April of 2023, the Clallam County in Washington County Commissioners signed an official proclamation recognizing and honoring Sasquatch. According to the proclamation, whereas legends, sightings, research, investigation, and recognition by various counties in various states support the notion that Sasquatch, aka Bigfoot, Yeti, and giant hairy ape exists, and whereas if Sasquatch exists, it is not flourishing given the very unusual event of being sighted, and it is likely an endangered species and subject to great harm and extinction if it continues to be unprotected. Whereas Clallam County desires that its citizens recognize the need to protect Sasquatch if it exists. Now, therefore, we, the Board of Clallam County Commissioners, hereby request all citizens of Clallam County recognize this county as a refuge for Sasquatch to prove both protection and security, and also supports the Forks Sasquatch Day, which takes place May 26th through the 28th, 2023. Signed this 11th day of April, 2023. Well, there you go. There you go, kids. You're Bigfoot. You make your way to Clallam County, Washington State, and you, my fine, hairy friend, ranging between 400 and 1,000 pounds in weight, height range 6'6 to 10 feet, big feet, stubby fingers, a bad odor, you got some freedom in Clallam County, Washington State. I don't know how much longer I can do this. I just don't. I mean, look, here's the official Clallam County website. If you want to, you know, is there a department of Bigfoot? You get a job. What do they got for jobs here in Clallam County? Ooh, you'd be an attorney, a maintenance worker. Ooh, sheriff's department, deputy. Huh. What's the qualifications to be a Clallam County deputy? There's a $10,000 hiring bonus. There we go. There's a written and physical ability test for entry-level candidates. How to apply. Well, there's some disqualifier stuff. Minimum 21. Be a citizen. Proof of diploma. Eligibility to possess a firearm. Application. Applicant must have normal color vision. Applicant must have vision correctable to 20/20. Uh-oh. Visible body decoration such as brands, body art, or intentional mutilation shall be covered. There you go. Okay. Criminal violations. You're disqualified. Any adult felony conviction. Any juvenile felony conviction within the past 5 years. Conviction of any felony crime of violence or misdemeanor domestic violence. Can't punch people. Conviction of any sexual offense. Any conviction of felony crime at any time while employed. Any single theft, property, or money in excess of $100 value within the last 5 years. There you go. There you go. There you go. Look at you. You guys living in Clallam County? There you go. You get yourself a job. You get yourself a job, kids. I'm trying to find the Department of Bigfoot. That's what I'm trying to find here in Clallam County. Isn't there a Bigfoot department? I just, ooh, holy cow. Interested in the current Clallam County inmate inquiry? There you go, kids. There you go. Search for your friends there. Finally, let's do our little missing 411 update this evening. We haven't done it for a few nights. I think it's about time. Let's discuss the profile points. I'm sorry. Again, if you've seen any of David Paul Politis's documentaries on one of the various streaming services, he has mentioned, actually, if you've listened to any of his YouTube channels. We don't promote that on here anymore because I don't like fiction, nor – let me restate that. I don't like people who embellish. But his profile point system is not a system. So somebody should maybe tell David Paul Politis that. If it's not consistent, it's not scientific. It's just, hey, this fits. Like my sister once said to me when I called her and I said, oh, this feels like about a tablespoon of baking powder or something. And she said, Mario, cooking is an art form. Baking is a science. You got to follow the 3x5 recipe card. If it calls for, you know, a cup of flour, you can't throw in a cup and a half. It's a cup of flour. What's actually really shocking is that some of his profile points – well, let me go over the profile points. I think that's important. Here are the profile points. Again, point of separation, time of disappearance, boulders – let's call them rocks in the field. Actually, isn't dirt just minuscule rocks? What a fly. Near water – there's a weather event. Disability or illness, which is interesting because I had thought Politis said he does not profile cases where the individual has a mental or physical disability. Canines can't track. We've discussed reasons why. Found it in an area previously searched. We've discussed how easily one can not be seen in photographs. Missing clothing. Politis obviously omits. Paradoxical on dressing. Unknown cause of death, according to Politis. In geographical clustering, which I've said many times on this program, Politis knows nothing about how clustering works. But what's more interesting is the profile points do not include, I don't know, trees. I say that not to be facetious, but because that's about as generic and nonspecific of a profile point as boulders nearby and weather. However, the only real profile point is national parks. And based on the number of national parks, just taking into account those in the contiguous 48, and the number of people that visit national parks collectively based on NPS.gov, stands to reason some people are going to go missing. I mean, you can easily say, yeah, they're vague, and B as in B, S as in S, and picks and chooses what he applies. But that's just, you know, low-hanging fruit. What is not low-hanging fruit is when he talks about disability or illness. That's just, I don't know, dumb and not true. Because in his first book, there's a story about some dude who was described as an expert survivalist who went out on purpose just to spend, you know, some time alone in the deep woods. He was healthy, well prepared, probably had more experience than most of us. And apparently he just vanished into thin air. You could also make the argument that just being a child is a form of disability, and there's some adult children out there. All right, kids, that wraps the first award-winning hour. Next hour, some more interesting stuff, and we'll head on over to bedtime stories. So get up, stretch your legs, get some water, do whatever you got to do, and join me, myself, and I in roughly 4 to 5 minutes. Talk to you then.
Who owns you? If you're not in control, then someone else is. Join me, Ivy West, for Voices on the Wind, Saturday. I discuss government, health, metaphysics, suppressed science, universal mysteries, little-known incredible facts, alternative energies, and even more than you can imagine. Won't you join us on Revolution Radio Saturdays for Voices on the Wind with me, Ivy West.
There are lives in the balance, people on the fire, children at the cannons. There are...
Because if your head's in the sand, your tail is a target.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the Internet. Please help support this station so this battle can continue forward. Revolution Radio!
There have been imaginative science fiction writers for generations.
Evasive.
But that doesn't mean that they're telling the truth as opposed to fiction.
I, you know, I'm aware of some archaeologists that have uncovered large bones indicating giants in Virginia. Genesis chapter 6, verse 4. There were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came unto the daughters of men, indicating that there were giants before the Nephilim.
And sons of God, plural. They weren't talking about Jesus coming down.
That's right. Yeah.
I'm Steve Crawford. Join me every Thursday night in Studio A at 6 p.m. Eastern for Factor Theory Live. Find us on www.revolution.radio. Great guests and great stories.
What do you believe?
Join me in the Brian Ruse Show on Revolution Radio, Eastern Standard Time, every Tuesday night from 6 to 8. We talk about the four most vital things, in my view, affecting all of humanity. Number one is UFOs and aliens and their agenda for the advancement of humanity. Number two is the Jewish establishment's control over all aspects of human civilization. Number three, the truth about Adolf Hitler, how he was the opposite of what we've been told. Number four is advanced ancient global civilizations. Join me on the Brian Roux Show, Tuesday nights from 6 to 8 on Studio B on Revolution Radio.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Any commercial advertising you may hear in this program is of the sole discretion and benefit of the host of this program you are listening to. Revolution Radio does not endorse any commercial products, nor does it accept monetary compensation for on-air advertising of commercial products, nor will it ever. We are and shall remain 100% listener supported. Any product advertising on this program are considered used at higher risk, and Revolution Radio shall not be held liable for any claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps. The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates. You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Dateline April 11th, 2023. Wait, that's not a paywall site, guys. Inside the Gateway Process, the CIA's quest to decode consciousness and unlock time travel. The goal, to convert the energy of your mind and body into a kind of laser beam that can transcend space-time. Oh. In 1983, U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel Wayne M. McDonnell was asked to write a report for the CIA about a project called the Gateway Process. His report, declassified in 2003, gives the scientific underpinnings as well as instructions and technical assistance to help people convert the energy of their minds and bodies into a kind of laser beam that can transcend space-time. The goal was to gain access to the intuitive knowledge which the universe offers, as well as travel in time and commune with other in-dimensional beings. Even more intriguing, one seemingly crucial part of the document, page 25, went missing for 40 years. The Gateway Project was originally the brainchild of Robert Monroe, a radio producer who shifted his focus in the 1950s to study the effects of certain sound patterns on human consciousness. His experiments led to his having OBEs, or out-of-body experiences. It also relies on the biomedical models of Bentov, a Czech-born Israeli-American engineer known for designing a remote-controlled cardiac catheter, creating diet spaghetti, and writing books about consciousness. What the hell is diet spaghetti? Do I need to Google this? I think I need to. I think I need to internet search diet spaghetti. I got no clue what that is. What is diet spaghetti? Is it keto spaghetti? Low carb spaghetti? I don't know. That's what I got. If anybody knows what diet spaghetti is, let me know. The premise of the Gateway method of transcending space-time also required quantum mechanical sources, which Lieutenant Colonel McDonnell wrote, quote, "describe the nature and functioning of human consciousness, and it leaned on theoretical physics to explain the character of the time-space dimension and the means by which expanded human consciousness transcends it." Finally, McDonnell had to put the whole package in the language of a physical sciences to avoid any unfortunate connection with the occult. In creating its unique methodology called HemiSync, The Gateway Project borrowed from various consciousness-altering methodologies, including biofeedback, transcendental meditation, Kundalini yoga, and hypnosis. Well, there you go. There you go. Links in the chat room if you want to read the full story. It is not a paywall. I'm going to put the whole entire title in the chat room so you can go and read it for yourself. It's somewhat lengthy, and I'm not going to go through the whole thing, just the highlights. That's the title of that particular story. Interesting. Interesting. Very, very interesting. According to a Harvard professor, so you know it's true, our universe is the result of a lab experiment by aliens. Link in the chat room. The Harvard professor behind this theory is Dr. A.V. Loeb, a respected theoretical physicist and chair of the astronomy department at Harvard University. Dr. Loeb has published numerous papers and articles on various subjects in astrophysics, such as black holes, cosmic inflation, and the search for extraterrestrial life. His controversial theory on the universe's creation has captured the attention of the scientific community and the general public alike. I don't think it has, but, you know, let's keep going. Dr. Loeb's theory, known as the laboratory universe hypothesis, proposes that our universe is a result of a scientific experiment conducted by an advanced extraterrestrial civilization. You know, if you've ever seen the movie Men in Black, I think after the first movie, when the movie ends, the credits rolling, it literally zooms out, and it finally gets to a point where there are two big, large aliens in our solar system, the Earth, the Moon, Mars, Venus, Neptune, Uranus, what have you, are nothing more than just balls on a petri dish or something. So it's somewhat interesting, but I'll continue. According to Dr. Loeb, this alien civilization could have created our universe by compressing a small amount of matter and energy into an incredible dense state, which then expanded rapidly due to a process called inflation. This rapid expansion led to the formation of our universe as we know it, with galaxies, stars, and planets forming over billions of years. Oh, so kind of like perhaps tonight at midnight when we have a rapid expansion of folks crossing a borderline. We can call that expansion because it's expanded rapidly. Dr. Loeb's theory is based on a few key pieces of evidence that he believes point to the possibility of an extraterrestrial hand in the creation of our universe. One of these is the fine-tuning of the universe's fundamental constants, such as the speed of light and the strength of gravity. These constants have precise values that are necessary for the existence of life and the formation of the universe as we know it. Dr. Loeb argues that the fine-tuning of these constraints could be the result of deliberate manipulation by an advanced civilization. One more piece of evidence to support Dr. Loeb's theory, is the unexplained nature of dark matter and dark energy, which make up a majority of the universe's mass and energy. Dr. Loeb suggests that these mysterious substances could be the remains of the experiment that created our universe, left behind by the ET scientists who conducted it. As you would well guess, there's some criticism and counter arguments. As you can imagine, Dr. Loeb's theory has faced significant criticism from the community. Critics argue that there is no direct evidence to support the laboratory universe hypothesis and that it is based on speculation rather than hard facts. Some believe that the fine tuning of the universe's constants can be explained by the anthropic principle, which states that the observed values of the constants are the only ones compatible with the existence of life as we know it. Others point out that the idea of the universe being created by extraterrestrial raises more questions than it answers, such as the origins of the advanced alien civilization itself. If our universe was created by aliens, then where did the aliens come from? This leads to an infinite regress making the theory difficult to accept as a viable explanation for the origins of our universe. And you are free to read the rest of the story, as I posted for you a link in the chat room. And then finally, getting back to Sasquatch, this comes from the Davis Report. So this dude, you know, spent, you know, some time with AI software and basically just imprinted a face, eyes, nose, mouth over a still image of the now famous Patterson-Gimlin video, which I, again, have no problem dying on this hill that I don't find it authentic. And I know that because I was not anywhere near Bluff Creek when this was shot in 1967, because, as you know, I identify as Bigfoot. So that's the news that is the news, my fine feathered friends. Am I missing anything exciting in the chat room? Because you folks are just wily. Let's take a look here. Let's take a look, as the big-time radio hosts like to say. Let's – who do we have next? John, Pensacola, Florida. You're on the – I'm kidding. John is not calling from Pensacola. John is not – I don't know who John is. Actually, speaking of John, Pensacola, Florida, it's kind of funny. I got an email. When was this? Yesterday. I said, oh, you got a your PayPal credit card was charged this for some Bitcoin. I went, oh, this is interesting. And I thought, oh, I'll play this game for a while. So I called the number, and then, you know, went to a voicemail, and then somebody from San Jose, California called me back. Now, look, if you're gonna pretend that you're a native English speaker, not the Queen's English, American English, you really got to hire people where their perhaps third language isn't English. So guy calls, and I said, yeah, question for you. I said, just wondering, I don't have a PayPal account, so how is it that my PayPal card was charged? And I said, oh, who am I talking to? And I said, John. He said, oh, my name is John Smith. Oh, is it now? And I said, I find this interesting. And he said, well, it looks like somebody hacked your account. And I said, well, that's interesting, because I don't have a PayPal account. And I tend to speak to folks where English obviously isn't their first language, the same way I speak to old people, somewhat slowly and loudly. And he said, well, they're, you know, a charge of $799. And I said, again, that's very interesting, but I don't have a PayPal account, so I'm uncertain how I can be charged for this purchase. Then the guy said, we'll call him John because that's what he called himself, do you know Mike Williams? And then I said, because I knew what he was trying to do, I said, I'm not quite certain what that has to do with anything. All I do know is I don't have a PayPal account. Well, it looks like – then he asked again, well, do you know this Mike Williams person? And I said, again, whether I do or don't know Mike Williams is moot. I don't have a PayPal account. I want to see how long I can keep the guy on the phone. And then I made the mistake by saying this. Well, help me understand this. What email address is registered with Mike Williams? Click, he hung up on me. I was very upset. I shouldn't have said that. I should have just kept him going for a long time. Then I try to call the number back, and they go straight to some automatic voicemail thing. Who's making fun? What creature's making fun of my picture? What are you talking about? You're about lavender? What are you talking about? Creature's still making fun of my picture. What picture are you talking about? What, the one that you posted in the room on Tuesday? The authenticated picture of me? The one that you claim is not me, but I say yes, it is. I just figured this out. You can click on the little bell, and it shows you all the notifications of everybody that sent you a direct message. Well, that's interesting. I did not sign out of chat when I hung up from the station on Tuesday, so it was literally open the entire time. Well, what creature are you talking about? Yes, Ned, it's all, everything is always blurry. That's why I like to tell people I'm out there posing for grainy photos. Wait, I don't know what you're talking about. You're talking about the conversation we had on... Wait, who's a shill? What are you talking about? You got to give me some context, Lavender. Talking about the conversation we had on Tuesday where you posted the photo of me and that was me and you said it wasn't me and I kept on saying, well, yes, it was. Then, hey, you happened to post a photo of my mother? I mean, no, hacking into my computer. How many creatures are going to come across the board? Many. Look, I'm not being facetious. This is a serious question, and I'm going to make sure I take my time and say what I want to say. Years ago, I made the argument that people receiving government assistance were double dipping. And I made this argument to a college professor I had. And he replied and said, well, how do you know that? And I said, the county I used to work for in Minnesota, I knew a number of folks that dealt directly with folks that received government assistance. And what these people would do is they would have two permanent addresses. At the time, one would be in Minneapolis and one would be in Chicago. And what they would do is they would drive or fly back to Chicago, most often drive or have something mailed, the check that was delivered to them in Chicago, and also a check that was delivered to them in Minneapolis. And he said, how's that possible? And he said he didn't think that was accurate. And I said, well, let me ask you this. I mean, I was a bit of a, I wasn't capping off or anything. I said, well, and at the time, I don't remember what the percentage of people were. I said, and this was just a few years prior. I said, there are roughly, I forget what percentage of people in Hennepin County were on some sort of government assistance. And I said, it's impossible to track all of those people. So now I tell you that to tell you this. Johnny comes across the border. Johnny, as all reports have indicated, throws their ID before they grow through, probably make up some name. They're seeking asylum, whatever they're doing. They're left onto American soil because no more rooms at the inn. I wonder how many of these folks, like Johnny, have familial contacts. I'm serious about this. Have familial contacts and then go to perhaps not one, not two, but three separate agencies with three different names, three different dates of birth, three different addresses, receive three separate whatever identification numbers they have, and receive government assistance. Even if they don't go that far, they go to assistant point number A, or letter A, I'm sorry. Tell them their name is, you know, I don't know, John Smith, whatever. Date of birth is this. They're living here. Okay, here's a voucher card or a preloaded a MasterCard with $2,000, whatever. Then they go to another one, and then another one, and another one. It's no different than what the scam that was being run by people with was it Katrina? Was it that far back? Was it the Katrina scam where people were just basically driving all over and getting preloaded cards with, you know, a balance of $2,000 or something on them? Was it Katrina? I forget. But back to my point, I'm serious. If you can't track these people, then who's tracking the numbers? I mean, you could literally walk across and have an arrangement with a number of family members. Okay, here are the points you go to. They're not going to be able to recognize these people because you got so many coming through. And give them, go to three different locations, give them a different name, date of birth, mailing address. Right? and you get whatever sort of vouchers or I don't know what they're doing for these folks. No, Lavender, I'm not saying who's giving. I'm just using an example, saying if in fact they are providing some sort of financial assistance to these people, it's impossible to track each individual. So each folk person could be double, triple, quadruple dipping in a single in over the course of, you know, I don't know, 3 to 5 days. There's a way to game the system. And if you look at some of the video of the folks who are hanging out waiting for midnight, it does look like these folks spent a lot of time crossing, you know, hundreds of miles. I saw a lot of clean looking fingernails. I'm just saying. Yes. I agree with you 100%. So I'm just trying to figure out how they track these people. And the answer is, well, they're not. There's no way to track them, because having reports come out that have said, look, we only have a capacity, so much capacity, and the rest. I think I told you years ago that I applied for to be a Border Patrol agent, and somebody messed up my application, and then it was some hoofla, but it didn't matter. But at the time, you had to take. Most of them were going to the southern border. So they said you had to either be fluent, pass a Spanish fluency test at 80%, or take like a 3-month intensive Spanish sort of class and then be able to pass an exam at 80% fluency or something along those lines. But I didn't do it because I had other stuff going on. But so they track them with telephones once they apply. Well, if they're using the old flip phones, those are impossible to track. That's why drug dealers use the old school flip phones, because you can't track them. Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out if there's got to be, look, you don't go to jail because you're smart and good looking, but you sometimes go to jail and you should earn an applied degree in just gaming the system. No, they accepted it, but the woman misread it, because I called her and misread it and actually apologized and thought I didn't have an advanced degree at the time, and I did have a master's. But by the time we got that cleared up, the interview process had already been concluded, and I couldn't go back to it. And she apologized, and then I called her supervisor and he apologized, and I said, well, you know, that's just the way it works. So they give out, I want to know what the dollar amount is though. I'm serious. I mean, does somebody have a link to it? I want to know what the broken down dollar amount is. Cause even, unless it's the double top secret government calling plan, but it's gotta be a prepaid with minutes cell phone. It's gotta be. Right? Here's your cell phone, prepaid, and you've got, I don't know, 60 minutes and an hour, I don't know, 180 minutes, three hours of talk time, 240 minutes, I don't know, 4 hours of talk time. No, I Lavender, I legit have a master's degree from a real college in university. Yes, it's accredited and accepted everywhere as a real degree. And the only reason I did it, honestly, was at the time the county I was working for was providing tuition reimbursement. But so you had to earn a B or higher. So after I got my grades, I'd bring the grades along with my financial aid, whatever report, and they'd reimburse me half of that. But then how they got you was they then added that reimbursement onto the next check and then taxed you. I'm not telling you where I got my degree. No, no. You want to talk offline? We can talk offline, Lavender, and I'll give you all the juice. No, but I want to know. So if they are in fact, hopefully you're not trolling me. But if they do give out phones, which I don't know if they're giving out thousands of phones, it doesn't make much sense. But for the folks that just travel through, there's got to be connections. There's got to be something. There has to be. And you're probably going to have 5-6 families deep living somewhere. Where would they have gone? I don't know. It's a mess, though. It's a mess. I think what they should do, and I don't know much about anything, but I think they should just load everybody up on a bus and take them, all the way to, wait for it, 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue Northwest. That's where they should bring them. That, my friends, is the official address of the White House. Take them all there and just have them hang outside by the gates. That's all you got to do. Yeah, okay, Lavender, I earned my master's back in 2002. So this was 21 years ago. 21 years ago. Actually, 21 years ago this month. Yeah. So I would have, I don't even know if they have it anymore. I know that the January 2nd, or no, I'm sorry, whenever the fiscal year started, which was that in July? Whenever the new fiscal year started, I was, even on my days off, I was the first person, you know, I tried to be one of the first people in the main office because it was really first come, first served. And they only had so much money. So I'd get the form and fill it all out and turn it in. So I would get it for the, yeah. So I think it was for that previous year. That's how it would work. Yeah. So it would work. Yeah. I don't know what they're doing then. I don't know where, I don't know if they're getting on buses, if they're going to, Janie or Johnny's house or where they're going, but this is what I sort of thought. And I don't know I've never been to the southern border, so I don't know the logistics of the system. If it's, you know, sort of a trough where you just kind of, you know, follow the red line to one gated door. What if the Border Patrol just says, you know what? We're not opening the door. We're not opening the we're not opening the door. What if who is it? Chief who's the Border Patrol police chief? What is his name? Or is he the director? What is he called? Ortiz, or is that his name? Ortiz? Is the Border Patrol chief last name Ortiz? I think it's Ortiz. Is it Raul? Raul Ortiz? Correct me if I'm wrong. What if he just says, don't open the doors? I mean, I'm serious. Just says, I'm defying orders. You can't open the doors. Go pound sand. I'm not opening the doors. Then what happens? You know, a lot are going to Texas. Can you imagine living on the southwestern border? I'm serious. I mean, look, I can you imagine? I wonder, I'm going to tell you right now, if I was living on the southwest border, I would have had a number of conversations with my neighbors to say, this is what we're doing. And I'm fairly certain most of those people tonight and probably numerous nights before have had people awake and sort of just monitoring their own streets. I if I was on the border, you know how many drones I would own? I mean, I'm serious. I'm not trying to be facetious here, but these are interesting times, are they not? And here's the funny thing, is that somebody might say, somebody, you know, might pose. Well, if you're so supportive of allowing all these migrants into the country, why don't you open up your house? Oh, no, no, no. And you know what? Now, wait for it. The reason they can say, oh, no, 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 is because they've already done their job, right? They've got their signposts in their front yard. They've got their various flag flying. They've done their bit. They've done their bit, right? That's the reply. No, no, I'm doing my bit. I've done my bit. So this will be interesting. Wow. This will be interesting. Who's that representative who said 13 years ago or so that Guam might tip over? Who's that senator, that Democratic senator that said that? Then what, again, there's a soundbite out there that, what, he said that if we don't let these migrants in, we're not going to be able to have food or houses built or hospitals cleaned or anything like that. I don't know. Sometimes you just got to say a couple of words. I don't know. And at first I thought that was a trolled, doctored photo of, Dianne Feinstein, but she looks rough. I mean, look, she looks, there's rough, then there's rough. All right, folks, bedtime stories. I mean, she looks rough. I'm not making any jokes. Rough.
This week on Bedtime Stories, we will be relating a number of stories pertaining to nocturnal mysteries. Instances in which those who work throughout the hours of darkness have been subjected to bewildering and inexplicable occurrences. Join us as we return to the night shift. In recent years, amongst the many subjects we have covered, none has resonated with our audience quite as much as our Night Shift episode. Our exploration of these eerie accounts experienced by night workers seemed to strike a chord with our viewers, resulting in a notable increase in the amount of subscribers reaching out to us. Many of those who contacted the channel related that they too had worked night shifts at some point in their employment, and they could strongly empathize with the experiences depicted in the episode. Some offered their own perspectives and personal feedback based on similar roles and experiences. A small number of respondents, however, told stories of how they too had encountered strange and unnatural incidents whilst working in the hours of darkness, and that they now felt emboldened to share their tales with us and their fellow viewers. As we have already covered in a previous episode, the remote city of Nome is somewhat notorious for its numerous unexplained disappearances. However, there is another, lesser-known aspect to this tiny city situated on the far western shores of the Alaskan wilderness, one in which residents have reported witnessing inexplicable occurrences which defy rational explanation. George, a subscriber who worked at the Nome Police Department in the late 90s, experienced a deeply unsettling event along with his fellow officers. Due to the region's unpredictable weather conditions, it was not uncommon for the staff of the Nome Police Department to be restricted in their movements by heavy snowfall from time to time. One night, during a particularly bad snowstorm, George and three of his colleagues found themselves working their entire shift within the confines of the police station, unable to go out on patrol due to the harsh weather. For the same reason, and due to the lateness of the hour, the volume of calls was minimal, but at around 2 a.m, George was at his desk catching up on some administrative tasks when one of his colleagues called him to the back of the office. on the CCTV monitor dedicated to the building's aging surveillance system, they saw a small figure walking towards the station, partially visible amidst the swirling snow. George initially thought it was a young child, but as he continued to observe, he realized that the figure's movements were confident and deliberate, not typical of a lone youngster. The figure approached from the plains to the east and finally arrived at the station, but instead of going to the main entrance as would be expected, it disappeared around the side. Wondering who on earth would be walking around in that weather and at that time, the two officers spent several minutes switching between various cameras before they were able to locate the mysterious figure once again. This time they saw that it was standing at the rear of the building, with its hands up over its brow, peering in through the window of one of the rear entrances. The poor quality of the CCTV system made it impossible to discern any details about the figure, other than its diminutive size and dark clothing. George remained at his post monitoring the camera, whilst his colleague went downstairs to investigate further. Moments later, he saw his fellow officer appear on screen, approaching the door where the figure was peering in. The officer's radio then sounded, stating that he was standing right next to the entrance and that he could not see anyone standing outside. George briefly began to suspect that he was the unwitting target of some prank, until he called over another of his colleagues from the other side of the office. They both stared at the screen and confirmed to each other that they could see the figure standing outside the doorway, and yet the officer downstairs reported back that it was clear. George asked his other colleague to continue watching the screen, whilst he made his way downstairs to join his partner at the rear entrance. Upon arriving in the hallway, he could see that there was nothing beyond the glass pane besides the raging blizzard outside, and yet the officer upstairs confirmed that the figure was still standing there, staring directly at both of them. Just as they were deliberating whether to go out and investigate further, they were summoned back up to the second floor. The officer at the CCTV monitor pointed to the grainy footage on screen, revealing yet another shadowy figure, identical in size and stature to the first, this time with its face pressed up against the glass of the double doors at the main entrance. At this point, George radioed the fourth officer on duty at the front desk, asking if he could see anyone at the doorway. When his colleague replied that there was no one there, he requested a closer inspection. Watching on the monitor as the officer approached the front doors, staring straight at the spot where the mysterious figure was standing, he was disturbed to hear the desk officer report back that the entrance was completely clear. As the hours passed and the snow continued to fall outside the station, several small figures materialized on the CCTV system, taking up positions at doors and windows, silently surveying the station's interior despite the harsh weather conditions. Physical checks by the officers revealed no signs of any intruders at the locations in question, despite them still being clearly visible on the CCTV monitors. Several hours later, as the storm began to abate, the squat shapes quietly disappeared, leaving no trace of their presence, not even footprints. The officers were left bewildered, unable to determine who or what those small figures were, where they came from, and ultimately, what their intent was on that dark and freezing cold night. Throughout her nursing career, Simona Galeano dedicated her skills to the Mexico-Americano Hospital in Guadalajara. Over the years, she bore witness to the best and worst of humanity, from heart-wrenching moments when patients had to be turned away due to a lack of appropriate facilities, to families and friends coming together to support their loved ones in the face of terminal diagnoses. But it was a traumatic event during the closing weeks of 2003 that left a lasting impression upon her. It revolved around a young male patient named Emilio, whom Simona was caring for. Emilio had suffered severe damage to one of his vertebrae, leaving him paralyzed from the neck down. Due to the nature of his injury, he was still able to breathe unaided and communicate normally, and despite his dire circumstances, Emilio remained surprisingly cheerful and optimistic during the 2 weeks he was under Simona's care. Intrigued by his positive outlook, she asked him how he managed to stay so calm in the face of such adversity. With an uncertain smile, the teenager tentatively revealed to her that he had been in contact with extraterrestrial entities since he was a young child. According to Emilio, these beings communicated with him telepathically, and after his accident, they had assured him that they could preserve his mind and soul, regardless of his physical condition. He went on to say that they had given him a specific date, the 3rd of December, when they would visit him at the hospital to separate his consciousness from his body and take him with them. Realizing that this date was only 3 days away, Simona initially dismissed this revelation as a possible delusion, induced by the amount of medication her patient was taking. However, despite her skepticism, she could not fully shake off the lingering sense of unease that Emilio's words had left her with. On the evening of the 2nd of December, Simona arrived at the hospital and clocked in for her shift, just like any other night, and made a point to check on her favorite patient. She found Emilio lying in bed, watching television, and after administering his medication, he soon fell asleep. Little did she know that this would be the last time she would see him alive. At approximately 3 a.m., an emergency alarm cut short a conversation between her and a colleague. Rushing to the nurse's station, they were horrified to discover that the alarm was Emilio's. His monitor was not showing any vital signs. They immediately sprinted to his room, only to find the sheets of his bed pulled back, and the teenager nowhere to be seen. A thorough check of the security cameras revealed no evidence of anyone entering or leaving Emilio's room. The hospital's wider CCTV network was also checked, but yielded no results. Just as the matter was about to be reported to the police as a possible kidnapping, an auxiliary, who had been helping to conduct the search, rushed up to the nurse's station and breathlessly informed them that Emilio was now back in his bed. Simona rushed into his room and was shocked to find Emilio lying exactly where she had left him earlier, with his sheets pulled back up and the monitor reconnected. To her horror, there were no signs of life in the youngster. He appeared to have passed away peacefully in his sleep. Further investigations, including a post-mortem examination, could not determine the cause of Emilio's death. There were no additional injuries or drugs found in his system beyond what was already documented in his medical file. The hospital's CCTV system provided no clues as to how Emilio had temporarily disappeared and then returned to his room, especially considering he was unable to move. The mystery of how he was seemingly removed from his bed and then returned without detection remains unsolved. Although he disappeared for only a matter of minutes, this brief event has left Simona pondering the existence of unknown forces or powers that may be beyond human comprehension. Emilio's remains were eventually buried according to the wishes of his loved ones, but the bizarre events surrounding his passing continue to haunt Simona to this day. During the summer of 2013, Carl Whitehouse found himself working for a private security company that operated across multiple sites in and around the southwest of England. The frequent travel to distant locations was taking a toll on his home life. Determined to find a more fixed assignment, he approached his manager to inquire about available opportunities. As luck would have it, the company had recently acquired a contract for a prison building which had been shut down by the Home Office earlier that year. The plan was to eventually convert the sprawling complex into a private venture, but for now, the company needed security coverage for the site. Two security guards had already been assigned to patrol the building to deter crimes such as metal theft and vandalism, but there was still one vacancy left to be filled. Given that the former prison was conveniently located close to Carl's home, he eagerly agreed to take on the role, as it would help him save on travel time and fuel costs. The following month, he received his new assignment and joined two other local contractors to provide 24-hour on-site security for the premises. Working in shifts of 8 hours each, the three security officers ensured that the site was always manned, with a dog handling unit available for backup if needed. Carl quickly familiarized himself with the layout of the aging building, devising patrol routes for its four internal wings and various outbuildings. However, it wasn't long before Carl experienced something quite out of the ordinary. Something that defied all reason and logic. Despite the monotonous nature of his work, he found the prison contract to be one of the best he had ever been awarded. Being native to the area, he knew the local community well, including the families of the occasional chancers he sometimes had to chase off-site. He had also taken the time to read up on the history of the facility, which had been used by the army during and after World War II, and he quite enjoyed exploring various parts of the old building during the darkest hours. One night, whilst deep in the bowels of the prison with only his torch to guide him, Carl heard a low rumbling sound that rapidly grew in intensity, causing the walls to vibrate. Intrigued rather than unnerved, he pressed on with his patrol, only to come to an abrupt halt as he turned a corner. The walls of the corridor in front of him were cracked and worn, with stones scattered on the floor where sections had given way. In some parts, the wall had completely crumbled, revealing a purplish hue of light from the night sky outside. Alarmed but curious, Carl retraced his steps, only to find that the walls of the corridor he had just passed through were similarly degraded. His confidence began to falter as he hurriedly made his way back towards the main entrance of the building. The other building surrounding the complex appeared to be in a similar state of decay, and the landscape outside, which had seemed ordinary in daylight, now looked almost apocalyptic under an unnatural purple moon in the night sky. As Carl moved out through the main doors and moved into the area where the car park used to be, he was utterly shocked as he saw a deserted wasteland stretching out before him, with the ruins of old buildings in the distance. From behind long dead trees and large boulders, he saw tall and slender figures, dark and unmoving. The hairs on the back of his neck stood on end as they remained where they were, intently regarding him from a distance. When one of the figures finally began to move towards him, affecting an odd, fluid motion, Carl turned and ran back into the depths of the prison. The rumbling sensation resumed, building in intensity, before abruptly ceasing. He emerged into a pristine corridor, identical to the one in which the encounter had begun. He cautiously retraced his steps, but there was no trace of the damaged walls or the purple sky he had seen just moments before. He continued to work at the prison for another year, but never experienced anything similar again, nor did he hear of any comparable encounters from his colleagues. He couldn't help but regard the old building with a sense of curiosity whenever he passed by it after his contract had ended, always wondering about what he had experienced there one night in the summer of 2013. Similar to the other encounters we have related, we are once again left puzzled and unable to fully comprehend the experiences shared by those who have come forward. Their stories defy rational explanation, pointing towards a peculiar phenomenon that seems to occur during the dark hours. It appears that as a species, we become more susceptible to the strange and bizarre during this time, isolated and vulnerable to forces beyond our comprehension. Those who work during daylight hours may never encounter such inexplicable occurrences, remaining unaware of the mysteries that unfold in the shadows of the night.
You know, thank you to our friends for our bedtime stories. I remember when I was a younger man and worked for a detention facility, and I would work the overnight shift. Either I was forced to work it or I picked it up for overtime, and it was 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. And there was minimal staff in the building. The really only interesting things that happened is if there were business calls or new juveniles coming in or some kid was banging and hollering, you had to bring him to, the quiet room. But I never saw anything that that was alarming. I mean, it was quiet, partly because what we used to do is you'd leave the mod because the control room would take the boards so they could hear if juveniles had a problem or something. We'd just go and do our hourly checks. But we'd sit and, we'd play spades or cribbage or just sit at a table drinking coffee and chit-chatting all night. We were dedicated state employees, I'll tell you that right now. Dedicated state employees. Jim Jones is here. I don't know if that's good or bad. All right, folks, that pert near wraps up the Thursday edition of the award-winning, but yet to be nominated, This, That, and the Other, heard every Monday and Thursday. You're on Revolution Radio, located at revolution.com. In your favorite internet browser, head over there to support us. Click on the donations tab if you're interested in hosting your own program, which I said I wasn't going to say, but I'm going to say it anyway. Click on the schedule link. Window opens up. You'll see Studio A, Studio B. If you see the all caps in white with black background open, it means it's open and you can host your own show. Somebody mentioned in the chat room that midnight Eastern time, the craziness begins. And I presume, is that the Keith AZ Live on Studio A, or is that Strange Universe doesn't come on until 1 a.m. Who hosts the roundtables? Are those things crazy? Nonstop crazy? And where's Jer-Bear done? Jer-Bear, you want to check out a long program. You check out Jer-Bear on Studio A from 4 a.m. Eastern until 10 a.m., 6 hours after hours with Jer-Bear. If I wake up early enough, which I'm always up that early, I'm going to tune in and contact him and probably harass him throughout the entire Sunday morning or Mother's Day. Speaking of that, have yourself a fabulous Mother's Day. We'll be doing some barbecuing. I'm going to some family members' home, and we'll be doing some barbecuing for Mother. And that's my weekend. Otherwise, that's it, kids. Call your mom. Call a mother. Order some flowers. Make some cookies. Just show mom you appreciate her. Or some mother. That's it, kids. Have a fabulous weekend. We will speak with you on Monday. If you're in Texas, best of luck. Or one of these southern states, best of luck. And we will chat with you when we chat with you. Up next on Studio B. I should really have memorized the entire schedule by now, but I haven't because, I don't know, slightly lazy. Up next, it's Reality Extraction with my favorite host, Mr. Roe, R-H-O. Otherwise, that's it. In the words of Katie Couric, good night, y'all. Ooh.
listening to Revolution Radio.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the internet. Please help support this station so this battle can continue forward. Revolution Radio!
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
I am Bill Johnson. Some consider my efforts to be an underground law school. I am not an attorney, and I do not give legal advice. I teach. That's lawful and legal. Consider yourself served. You are to appear Wednesday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern, Studio A. My forte? Foreclosure and contract law. Grab your legal pad and pen. Learn a broad spectrum of law, spanning administrative, criminal, family, tort, and federal law. Fools and losers cling to old cases. I dissect and comment on the latest rulings that control the courts. Don't be a loser.